HDR 24 and HDR 25.
The organization will come to order. My attendee is excused. Our first hearing will be House Joint Resolution 20. Representative Hurd.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. I introduced House Joint Resolution 20 at the request of the Klamath Basin Snowdrifters. This followed a proclamation that Governor McCall signed back in December declaring this year, January 10th through January 16th, as Winter Sports Week. And it was a feeling at that time that that would be a good first start, and then if the legislature could go ahead and plan this accordingly for every successive year, that this would help this group in a winter carnival that they're attempting to start, and it would spotlight winter sports. This would be all winter sports, and something that seems particularly appropriate to the state of Oregon.
Where is the carnival, Fred?
They're starting one in Klamath County, and then considering the snow activities in Jackson County, and this seems to be certainly a growing thing, with skiing becoming more and more important every year, and certainly this is something that would be applicable to winter sports every place where there's snow in the state of Oregon. As I say, this came from this particular group in Klamath, but certainly it would apply to snow areas throughout the state where we might be.
Are there any religious implications?
No, no religious implications.
Is anyone opposed to the idea?
I haven't heard of any. What? Governor McCall thought it was a good idea when he signed the proclamation.
Touch it. Are there any other questions?
Certainly this has some tremendous implications to Representative Johnson's area.
Good or bad?
Very good.
Where did I find it?
Here.
Yeah. Back to the book.
What happens once, if this should become law, what happens, Fred? What's the next step? Do they publicize it?
Yeah, they'll publicize it, and then Congressman Ullman has indicated that he will carry it on in the Congress and try to get those business in the national attention in Oregon and his sports affairs and so on. He has received a copy of this resolution and is waiting.
Would we take any state observance of it, or would they left the local community?
It'd be up to the local community.
There's a typo in the bill, incidentally, on line 6.
Yeah, enjoy.
Okay, if there are no more questions, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else who'd like to testify on House Joint Resolution 20? Thank you very much. We'll turn to House Joint Resolution 21. Anybody here to appear on House Joint Resolution 21? Did the sponsor just mention it? Well, we'll wait a while on that and see what happens.
Who is the sponsor?
Robert Schellick. House Joint Resolution 24. Tom Scanlon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Tom Scanlon. I represent the Oregon AFL-CIO. And I'm appearing here today in opposition to HDR 24, which would modify the prohibition against putting the emergency clause on taxpayers. I made it a point before I came up here to check the vote in 1956 in which a measure to permit the tax measure to go into effect immediately was before the people, and the vote that time was 487,550 against, and $175,932 for. And I know several attempts have been made since then to put on the ballot something that would, in some manner, permit tax measures to go into effect so that a referendum could not be used against them. But our position has not changed in this. It's simply our convention position that we think the people should have the final say and be definitive in the matter. We also think, I've talked this over with some of our officers, we also think that if this type of proposal is to be put again, that this is not the best climate among the people to offer it. And I think, without elaboration, I think that the legislators know what we're talking about when we make that reference. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions if I could.
Any question, Mr. Cameron?
When was that vote that you were...
That was in 1956. It was referred by the 1955 legislature.
Do you generally feel that most all issues, as many as possible, should be referred to the voters?
Well, you're talking about a lot of issues. I would say we do think that financial issues and the use of the emergency clause something should, prohibition is maybe about something not to be left to the people.
Would you briefly run through the emergency clause, what that provides?
Well,
for the benefit of our audience.
Yes, the present Constitution says, it is very simple language, it's the reason I referred to. This is rather incidentally, and there's no one here I guess to present it, Dr. Cherry's bill, and it's one of what I call one of these complicated amendments. Which is not nearly as simple as is the emergency prohibition itself. And the present prohibition reads in the Constitution, the Legislative Assembly shall not declare an emergency in any act regulating taxation or exemption. That's it. Now, if I recall in 1956 that there was a much simpler proposal to do away with the prohibition rather than these complicated ones that have been used, you know, been proposed in session since. If you would like me to read what is proposed in this resolution, as you said, for the benefit of those that are listening, I'll be glad to do it. It says, if the Legislative Assembly declares an emergency in an act regulating taxation or exemption, such act becomes effective only if the Legislative Assembly refers to the people for their approval or rejection at the next regular general biennial election. A measure proposing the repeal of such act. If the measure proposing the repeal is approved by a majority of the votes cast thereon, then the repeal becomes operative on the next succeeding July 1st, unless the measure proposing the repeal specifies an earlier operative date. Unless otherwise provided in the measure proposing the repeal does not affect any liability or penalty incurred under such act, regulating taxation or exemption prior to the time its repeal becomes operative.
Came pretty well prepared, didn't you? Are there more questions, Mr. Scanlon? Mr. Scanlon, how many other states have this provision in their state constitutions?
If I remember correctly, I believe we are the only state that prohibits this, but of course I would like to really add to that. I think if we look at the financial condition generally over the years, a long view, you will find that tax-wise we are in better shape than probably any other state.
Don't you believe our constitutional requirement that the budget must be balanced might have something to do with it?
It could very well be.
Do you believe that having this provision in the Constitution in any way works a hardship on the legislature and their responsibilities?
Yes, I do. I really do. We have to choose between the people and the members of the legislature.
Oh, I wouldn't put it that way.
Well, what I'm saying in relation to working a hardship, I really think that it does.
Well, what you mean when you choose between the people and the legislature,
well,
you're saying the legislature's ability to perform their responsibilities.
Right.
I thought that's what you said. I wasn't quite sure. Are there no other questions of Mr. Chairman? Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you.
John Danielson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Danielson. I represent the Oregon Education Association, and I reside at 6655 Southwest 67th Parkland. Representative Cherry introduced this bill on our behalf, and I would like to point out some of the problems that, some of the history that has gone behind this particular proposal. As you are probably all aware, the Oregon Constitution is the most restrictive in the country with reference to the powers of the Legislative Assembly and the ability to enact tax legislation. And even though we have constantly heard that back in 1956 they did such and such, we are still well aware that the voting population of Oregon has changed substantially since 1956. And also, I think it should be recalled, those of you that were here in 1956 and participated in that election, or at least aware of it, might recall that the issue became a sales tax issue rather than a real issue of whether or not the legislature should have the power to actually enact the emergency clause on tax legislation. We recognize that there is a rather populist type of an instinct, and which may have adverse effects perhaps on the real concepts of representative democracy, which is essentially that you elect a representative to make some of your decisions, because you can't call all the people together to make them all. And that, of course, is part of the basic theory of having a legislature in the first place. One of the major functions of the legislature is obviously to provide those funds for those programs which cannot be individually provided by individuals in the state. Now, in recent years, we've run into an extreme amount of chaos in local government. I think we've survived it all very nicely, and Oregon has retained, I think, a reasonably good position in terms of state services provided and local services provided. But let me give you a couple of examples. A couple of years ago, in fact, starting back in 1965, we had, I think, three or four continuous years of relative campaigning on and off in terms of a 1.5% limitation on property taxes, which would have left very major deficits for local government at all levels. We have had 1% tax limitations proposed by initiative process, and they have not been successful in reaching the voters. We also at the present time have pending a proposal which would limit the use of property tax for school purposes. And of course, it is being represented in various places around the state as saying that we will support another alternate tax. And by we, I don't mean the Oregon Education Association, I mean the Farm Bureau, for the sponsors of the program, of an in lieu of program. But I don't believe people are really aware of the magnitude of the kind of the tax it would take. For example, something like a 9% sales tax is an alternative, or 2.5 times the income tax to substitute for that very vast property tax load that is presently being carried in support of school costs. So what we're saying is that in spite of the fact that we have gotten by so far to this point, that we've had really a type of brinksmanship in financing of local government, in that if one of these measures, who for one reason or another was to pass, then in fact what would happen would be that the legislature would have great difficulty, or could conceivably have great difficulty, in financing either local government services or state government services, and I presume their choice, because they would have the decision of establishing the priorities inside of existing revenues. So we believe that it really is, in fact, a legislative function to make a determination of what kinds of taxes should, in fact, be prepared, what kinds of taxes should, in fact, be enacted for the purposes of funding both state and local governments. Now, at the present time, I think you will note, and I think this has been present at least for the last three sessions of the legislature, an attitude of negativism on those committees that are responsible for developing tax programs, and certainly an attitude of frustration. And the reason being that they know full well that any tax program of any magnitude that they prepare is going to probably have to be referred, and if it is not referred then in fact it would be referred by the people. And so what you end up with then is, in many cases, I think, there's a reluctance to say, we're going to put this tax into effect instead said that we're going to put this tax out for a vote of the people to see if it might go into effect. And I think this makes a difference on the manner in which people would accept this responsibility. And I'm not attempting to say that people aren't taken seriously, I believe they are. But I think there is an additional burden when you know that the tax that you sign into law is going into effect immediately versus the fact that it probably never will go into effect because of what will happen at the polls. So we believe that it is necessary to establish that the legislature should have the authority to in fact maintain operation of government programs, which they don't now have. We also believe that the people certainly should have some right to reject certain forms of taxation. So on this particular program, which I think was earlier known as the Mann Plan some time ago, this attempts to compromise the position. It says to the legislature, you may put the emergency clause on tax legislation. You may enact that tax. You may start collecting for that tax. But on the other hand, that tax is going to be referred to the next biennial general election. And the people will vote on it. And we feel at that particular point that rather than listening to the politics going pro and con on the thing, that they would have had the opportunity to have actually experienced the tax and to see how it actually did affect them. And therefore, they would be able to cast a more intelligent vote on that particular program. So from the standpoint of the group of people that tend to refer tax measures, we feel it's to their advantage. We save them the time, effort, and expense of going out there and getting the 29 or 30,000 signatures that are necessary to refer it. And they automatically will have it referred. We follow the same concept I think was followed in Idaho when they first implemented that sales tax, that they tried it a while and then they voted on it. And sometimes experience on a tax is a little different than how it is represented at the time that you're having the campaign. We believe that if there is going to be continuity of government over the long haul in Oregon, that a measure such as this one is going to be necessary. This measure has never been voted on in Oregon. We attempted an initiative campaign following the 1967 legislature. We started it something like 45 days before the deadline, and we gathered some 30,000 signatures, which we presented in the 1969 session to the tax committee to indicate that there at least was some level of support for this, as we collected those signatures in less than 2 months' time. It's a simple proposal. It may not sound like it when you read it. It simply says, put the emergency clause on it if you like, do, it'll have to be referred to the next general biennial election, and then if the people defeat it, the tax becomes void on the next July 1st. You may have a hodgepodge of tax programs if one of these limitations measures goes through, but at least you would be able to maintain financing. We know that the Gallup polls show generally nationally that people want property tax relief, something like 56% of them want it. But we haven't really come upon the manner in which they seem to want it here in Oregon as we've tried various alternatives. But that doesn't change the fact that in spite of the opposition to proposed tax programs to date, it is generally, I think, recognized that people do wish to shift some of that property tax burden to other forms of taxation. And so we think that it's necessary in some cases to actually experience it before voting. Mr. Chairman, we would recommend that this measure be referred out with a due pass recommendation. And we think that it would be advantageous to the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Don. Other questions?
When you came to testify on behalf of this measure, John, did you have come by directive of your executive committee, by vote of your membership of OEA, or just how do you determine it?
We have a dual pattern. The way we develop our legislative program is through what we call a representative assembly body, which has representation from every unit we have in the state based on the number of members in that unit. I think it's one representative in the first 50, one for the next 100, and so on, and there's a special condition for small locals. We took up this program initially in 1968 when it was presented to us, to our Board of Trustees, by Representative Mann, and I believe Skelton and Roberts, who were at that time promoting an initiative campaign. And we also had an alternate proposal which came before our representative council in 1968, which was a progressive sales tax, in other words, a tax credit sales tax. The tax credit sales tax thing was defeated, and the decision was made by that representative body to go by initiative process to try to put this on the ballot. Now, unfortunately, this doesn't meet until very late in March, and then, of course, by the time you get all your drafting done and then 30-day waiting period, well, you're running very late for an initiative. We have sustained the position since in support of either repealing the emergency clause on tax legislation or on this proposal. Now, I have been instructed that we felt this had more political feasibility than a straight repeal of the emergency clause. We would support either one.
Your predecessor in the chair mentioned that we voted this down in 1956. Do you recall how many times you voted on daylight savings?
I don't recall the number, but as I recall, it took a fairly sophisticated campaign to remove the opposition and some conditions in other states on the coast and a few other things. We did vote on it more than once. But this isn't the issue we voted on in 1956.
John, what is the reluctance for the voters to approve such a measure? I know the general opinion is negative.
We have not taken any polls on this particular thing. I think that there is generally a negative attitude concerning taxation, and certainly if this is presented at a time when it appears that the first thing the legislature is going to do is go back and enact a particular kind of a tax, which was the case in 56, then I think you're going to result in some difficulties. I do think that the voters in Oregon have, over the long haul, been very responsible, and I'm not sure that this kind of a measure that you wouldn't get a pretty good run on at this time. I'm not prepared to say that I don't think it has a chance. I think the odds are that it might not pass, but on the other hand, I think you can make a pretty good run.
Did you say this is similar to Idaho law or identical?
No, I'm not familiar with what they actually have in statute. It's the way that they implemented their savings tax. But I believe the Idaho legislature has taxing powers.
Yeah, I know they do. But they did refer the sales tax.
But they referred it
after it had been
time they've done it. But that was done by legislative discretion rather than by constitutional provision.
But it had already been enacted, hadn't it? And was a part of their tax structure by the time they
right.
got it.
But they didn't have to refer it. They just chose to do so.
Okay, thank you, John.
Thank you,
Dr. Cherry, would you like to testify on this bill?
Mr. Chairman and committee, I'm Howard Cherry, a member of the legislature. I think the first thing I probably should talk about is how come that this is sponsored by one person and that person happens to be me. This, I was approached by the representative of OEA to ask if I would sponsor it, and I stated that I would, and I think that someone should sponsor it and it should come before the attention. As I analyze it now, it seems to me that any one person that sponsors this thing is either very secure with his electorate, that he does not care whether he's elected next time, or is a darn fool. And the more I look at this, the more I think maybe it's a third alternative that caused me to sponsor something that might be as unpopular in my area as this might be. Now, as to the bill, it is most interesting as a freshman legislator and having been in a partisan election once, that as you knock on doors or you walk down the street, you ask what is the most important issue, and it's not occasionally, it's about 99% of the time it's to cut our taxes. And that there is, without doubt, and I'm sure in every one of your districts too, that this is the predominant request of the legislature. Then as getting down here as a freshman legislator, I observe, and I think this is accurate, that the hardest job of the legislators is to provide the essential and desirable services to the state within the limitation of the taxes. And this. These are just almost irreconcilable. The next big philosophic thing about it that I see is whether or not the legislature should be a responsible body in the field of taxes. And with the experience three times in recent years, one party has put up taxes, the other party is elected next time. Didn't quite happen this time, but made quite a difference after the election last time, which means that now, when the legislature no longer looks at what tax or what tax is the fairest, what tax will yield the money that the legislature needs, but what tax can we get by without having it preferred? Or is there a combination? Or is it one class of people that will be hurt more than another because, and possibly that we will not have trouble getting it by? And I think that this is wrong. I think that the legislature should have approximately equal responsibility in tax measures as it has in all other measures. That is, we're here to vote, we're here representing the people, we do the best we can, we'll put it out and give it a try. And that's all really that this does. I don't think this will pass, but I think the people probably should have a chance to vote on it. And I think if they're sometime we're going to get to the situation and things are bad enough in this state that it will pass. But if there are not, I don't know. I think it's good legislation. I think it's responsible. I think it would give the legislature the responsibility which they should have and should pick up with this. I think that's all my testimony.
Thank you very much, Dr. Terry.
This bill also requires that the people do have an opportunity to vote. And as Mr. Danielson pointed out, that really the only benefit is that we would enact the tax legislation would go into effect and have a chance for people to see what it was like, and then they are required to vote.
Yes. What I think will happen here is that if we pass responsible legislation, it's on the books, it's had the rounds once, then the people will not just vote blindly, it's a new tax, we don't want it, but we'll have a chance to look at it. Is this particular tax worth and to do the things that we want done and want to pay for? I think that it's very responsible. I think it's better that it's automatic than if it has to be initiated, and it's a lot of bother with many names that it takes to initiate. I think what this does is not go the whole way, but goes the part way, and it is a responsible bill in that matter.
Lee? Could you describe this as an educational process for the voters?
Well, I think it is to a degree that it anything that we propose that the people will vote on certainly does create a forum where all the arguments and throughout the state will be discussed, and people will be better informed on the merits and demerits. Yes, I think it is.
Dr. Cherry, there was a general impression among some legislators last session that the OEA was going to support the sales tax, and nothing happened. Do you have any idea what the OEA will do if this is referred to people?
I would like to say that the OEA would be the last people in the world that would consider that I am their spokesman. I could do a better job of reacting as the school board did, or as I do personally about the bill last time. I think the bill was not a clean bill. That it did not, I think the bill, if it were tied directly to education or didn't have so many restrictions, might have been looked on different by the OEA. But I prefer you to ask that question from someone in here.
I don't want you to think you're out on a limb all alone sponsoring this legislation. I sponsored a bill that I didn't even believe in. You're not as bad off as I am. Okay, if there are no more questions, John?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to respond to your question.
Yes, I'd like to have you respond to my
question. You are not designating me as your mouthpiece.
Well, you're just tickled to death to have you with us on this bill, Representative Cherry.
Will you please respond to my question, John?
Yes, with reference to the sales tax that was referred during the last session of the legislature, I think we've indicated to the House Tax if certain conditions were appropriate, and that we would in fact support the bill. One of those conditions was distribution to the basic school support fund, and we held with them to that point. When when the committee made the change, where they distributed it to, in a different manner, then we could no longer support the package. But I think we were very clear, well in advance of the time that that decision was made, that that was a condition that must be met if they expect our support in the bill. If that condition was not met, we took no position on the bill.
John, that wasn't a part of my question. I wanted you to answer.
All right, you want to know what we would do with this?
Yes.
We would support it. Thank you.
Yeah, you get these, get a lot of way ahead while you're... Are there any more questions of Dr. Cherry? We thank you very much, sir, for coming. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify on House Joint Resolution 24? Not, the hearing is closed on this House Joint Resolution 25. Dr. Cherry. Well, I just wanted to get that exercise.
House Joint Resolution. My name is Howard Cherry. I'm a member of the legislature in Northport.
Is that a confession or?
I'd like to respond to that about 5 minutes, but I won't.
This committee is somewhat informal, Dr. Cherry.
I will have it noted that on the floor of the House yesterday, I announced I was proud that I was from Jefferson High School, which is one of the most active and of many scenes of high schools in the state of Oregon. I am proud of being from Marco.
Never mind. The people are not on the committee. You must ask permission to speak.
Must not speak.
This is another bill that I signed at the request of the OEA, and I think it is a good bill. I will not speak at length on it. Primarily, I will say that this is a position that requires a very responsible and well-trained specialist in education, and that education is not a partisan matter. It's not a matter of which the political appeal or the political power of a person should be involved in his appointment. What this would do would be have the State Board of Education appoint or select the superintendent instead of having it a vote of the people. I'm reminded when this happened once before that someone got up and said, well, someone had testified against this concept and said, well, maybe we should elect the warden of the state penitentiary. And they were shocked. You can't do that. It's too specialized a field. It's the tremendous responsibilities in keeping these people in line. And it seemed a little bit ridiculous to say that the warden was more important to be highly technically trained than the person that heads the education of our children from through elementary and high school and now including community college. And this, I would call your attention to the fact that this would allow the state superintendent to be hired in the same manner as every other superintendent in the state of Oregon. There is a responsible board. That board would look for the best superintendent they can and would hire him on his qualification as an educator and not on his ability to secure votes. I think this is an important concept. Again, I have a notion that it's a minority concept at the moment, but possibly it could pass. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cherry.
Are there any statutory qualifications for standing for that office?
There is a companion bill that is in the for the legislature at this time that would state the qualifications. At the present time, there's none other than that they must be a citizen and resident and so forth. It does say you must be a resident of Oregon for 5 years. But you do not have to. In fact, one candidate and one election stated that I have 9 children, and anybody that has 9 children must know enough to take care of the education in Oregon, and he was qualified to run for the office.
So presently, for this elected position that we have now, there's
no
basically
educational
no qualifications.
Standards, that's correct. Dr., who's the fellow Parnell that did the first time around and the second? What was his name?
Was there some argument that he was or was not qualified? It seemed to me like there was kind of maybe Tom.
To correct the record, Dr. Minear won over him once, and Dr. Parnell won over him once.
Anyway, the same man.
He
was out of Willamette here, wasn't he? And
he was dean of students at Willamette. He had a doctorate in an education field. He was a highly trained specialist in reading. He did not have an administrative credential, and he was not eligible for an administrative credential.
But the question was, would he have been qualified then, or whatever, in the statute?
Under the present law, he was qualified to run. Under the bill that is going through at the present time, that is in the process, he would not be qualified. Even though he was an educator in other respects.
Do you know the number of that companion bill by any chance?
1581, my coach said.
Dr. Cherry, has the problem of who's the boss, the constitutionally elected superintendent of public instruction or the state board, been completely resolved?
It's my understanding that the Supreme or the Attorney General's opinion, while Minear was still here, in which an issue came up that there was a disagreement, and that it was resolved, at least in this issue, that the state superintendent was the boss.
Then there really is no use in having the state board under these circumstances.
The relationship between the superintendent and the state board are certainly different under the present law than would be in ordinary either business or a school district in which policy is formed by the board and not by the superintendent.
So speaking of Representative Kennedy, then in reality we have no lay input into the board.
I don't think it's as bad as that, especially at the present moment where the both the superintendent respects the board and the board respects the superintendent, but there's no guarantee that this can't happen. In fact, you can look south a short distance where education is tremendously disrupted because elected superintendent and the board were not in agreement at all.
They said to move to a distant southern state.
Something like that.
How is the Chancellor of Higher Education?
Chancellor of Higher Education is selected, I believe, by the State Board and confirmed by the Senate. The State Board of Higher Education and confirmed by the Senate.
Are there any more questions of our capable witness?
Have you talked to Dale Parnell on this and gotten anything from him in the reaction of any kind?
I have not very recently, but I have previously, and he was in favor of this.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cherry. Ms. Bigland, in a moment.
I'd like to have Dale Parnell here.
Yes, they told me that he was here, or the deputy, that was coming to that meeting.
The duty shall be spelled out by whom?
Board.
By the board?
Board. Today, it all comes to the bottom up.
Does that bill about the chairs provide how the state board is it still appointed?
Tell the state board, no change. Ms. Cleveland?
I'm Ms. Cleveland, legislative chairman for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I've given you a copy of my very brief statement, and I won't read it to you, but I will paraphrase it just to say, that we support this measure. We supported for a long time a reduction in the number of elected officials in the executive branch in the Constitution, and we will support at the appropriate time House Bill 1581, which is the Uniform legislation. We will support this on the ballot if it gets to the ballot. And we do not think it is appropriate for an administrator to do it.
Thank you. Other questions, Mrs. Cleveland?
Oh, did you have a question?
Well, while you're here, Mrs. Cleveland, how does the league feel about electing the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, and the Labor Commissioner?
We have supported the commission document, which got down to two. Our original position was that we wanted only one elected official in the Constitution in the executive branch. And then at the time of the commission, we broadened that to be two, and they would run in tandem so you wouldn't have this succession problem.
Would this be the Lieutenant Governor?
Well, we've called it Lieutenant Governor, but we wouldn't really care what it was called if it took care of the succession problem and if it limited the executive. And we have, I hate to be questioned too closely on what we supported in the last session because there were two or three different kinds of executive reorganization, constitutional executive reorganization last time. This was one of the things we're most anxious to do. And there are a lot of other things we'd like to do with the Constitution, like get rid of the two articles on the judiciary and other things like that.
Well, it wasn't fair for me to ask you that question without coming prepared for it.
If you don't, if I can't answer, I'll just say so. Okay. It's 50 words.
What is your basic objection to having elected representatives within the executive?
Elected
individuals within the executive department.
Well, our basic objection in our constitutional study was there were too many, and that the executive was so diffuse that you could never know who did what, or that you couldn't pin it down, or that it goes back to 1953. But the basic assumption was to simplify the executive department and make a line which the citizen could more readily identify responsibility and hold the elected person responsible.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Danielson.
I think you can see by this bill that it's from the sponsorship here that it's one that has broad bipartisan support, at least, which perhaps the other one did not have. I would indicate to you, Mr. Chairman.
Broad support, Jerry and Markham.
I would indicate to you, Mr. Chairman, that there are a number of reasons why we believe that the State Superintendent of Public Instruction should be an appointed position. And first of all, I think which was that this is clearly a different position from those others in state government in that you have a lay board which is at least theoretically responsible for the matter of administering such things as state standards and policies generally of elementary and secondary education. And there is no other state officer that has this kind of a situation. It is, I think, also significant to note, and I believe there is a more recent Attorney General's opinion which has ruled that the State Board is the higher body of the two, and this, is, I think, would be a more recent one. And this, of course, to us presents a rather an unusual situation where you have an appointed board basically over an elected constitutional officer. In fact, to us, very frankly, it doesn't make very much sense. There is absolutely no recourse to the State Board if the State Superintendent tells them to go fly to the moon on a particular issue. He can go his merry way because he is elected in response directly to the electorate. I point out to you that in the manner of administration of elementary and secondary education, that we already have a vast number of elected public officials in the local district boards, and the real decisions are made, I think, at the local level by these elected people. The State State Superintendent of Public Instruction administers policies of the State Board with reference to certification. He administers policies of the State Legislature with reference to basic school support and the distribution of that support. He provides assistance to local districts in the matters of how to work out their budgets, budget accommodations, management practices, and all of these functions are clearly administrative functions. We do not believe that the number one head administrator of the largest public business in the state of Oregon should be spending a large amount of his time on the campaign trail as is necessary to maintain public office. We do not believe that the office is lucrative enough from a monetary point of view to really entice very many highly trained people in this area, because the salary level at that office is considerably below that which is normally paid for people in non-elective educational offices. Now, there may be a prestige level here, but certainly in some of the campaigns in the last 4 or 5 years where you're looking at $50,000 or $60,000 campaigns, which indeed is moderate for a statewide election, it's really not the type of thing that is going to attract people that are professionally competent in the field of education on much of a scale. We believe that even though the measure was referred in 1966 and prior to that time through legislative discretion, it had been appointed for a few years, and then of course it was overturned on a suit brought by the then Senator Musa, that there was really no problem during the time that it was served as an appointed position. And then of course the court reversed it, and then it was referred back to the people in 1966. We do not really feel that at that time it's a true indication of what the popular attitude might have been. And as was earlier presented by Representative Markham, the race then ensued between Dr. Manier, who was the person that had been appointed by Governor Hatfield to fill the position, and by Dr. Walter Blake from Willamette University. And of course, part of the thing that came out was if the constitutional change was made, that the implementing statute would have made Dr. Blake ineligible as an individual to serve in that position, even if he had won the election, because he did not hold the proper administrative certification. So what that meant then is, if you were an advocate of Dr. Blake for State Superintendent of Public Instruction, and as you will recall, back in that election, Dr. Blake came very, very close to unseating Dr. Manier, then you almost automatically had to vote no, we don't want it to be an appointed position because we want Dr. Blake. On the other hand, among those that voted for Dr. Manier, then you did have a group that believed it should be an elected position, but they believed that Dr. Manier was, of course, the individual they wanted. So what you had in that election was a rather compounding of the no vote, and as a consequence, the measure went down to defeat. But as you might also recall, it was probably one of the major issues that was discussed during that campaign. So we believe that the people of the state of Oregon ought to have a chance to vote on this measure at a time when it's a clean measure and it's not affected by the personalities involved as to who may or may not be superintendent of public instruction. Consequently, we think that it should come out at the next primary election at a time when the state superintendent is between elections, and the decision should be made at that particular time. This measure was introduced in the last session of the legislature. I think it actually passed some committees at the time that they had thought that the superintendent had been elected for 4 years. It was later determined he had been elected for 2 and then must run again. And at that time, they determined that it was not wise to combine both the election of the official and also the issue of whether it should be elected or appointed on the same ballot. So, Mr. Chairman, we believe this should be presented at the next primary election. And then if it's defeated, then probably the matter should be left alone for a while. But on the other hand, we think that people should have a chance to vote on the issue as a clean issue rather than one that's cluttered with individual personalities. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, John.
The Oregon Education Association also, have they taken a position on 1581 and the provisions of that?
Yes, we have. 1581 is the implementing proposal. It's all part of a package, but because it is necessary to refer it here, it requires the HJR. We are in support of both packages, and we'll campaign on their behalf if they have to get out there for people to vote.
1581 won't be referred to people.
No, but 1581 is enacted contingent upon passage of that kind of thing.
Wait.
blunt deal.
Right.
Will OEA have more influence if the superintendent's appointed than if he's elected?
Frankly, on the matter of the state superintendent of public instruction, I don't believe that we're going to have disproportionate influence either way, very frankly. Certainly, we work with the State Department of Education. We work with the State Board of Education, the State Superintendent of Education. We do not always support their proposals. I think yesterday, the nearest incident, we opposed them on a measure in the Rules Committee. There have been at least three instances this legislature we have contrary positions. State Department and the State Superintendent do not normally take positions on matters of personnel, negotiations, tenure, and those kinds of things. Those are the kinds of things that we have most variation with local boards. Probably 80% of the time we're in accord with local district boards, the state board, and the State Department of Education. And in that 80%, and I'm talking now OSBA, that 80% of the time we're in agreement with there, that's about the 80% of the stuff that the State Department of Education usually comes in with. I don't believe that our motivation here is to attempt to have influence. Certainly we would have more influence on an elected official if we were to substantially contribute to his campaign. We would not expect, I think in the best interest of education, we like to see the best individual possible in that position, and certainly we would make contributions. We expect no commitments as opposed to that.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Mr. Scanlon, do you have a position on this?
I did not plan to testify. If I remember correctly, I believe that we have, in past years, opposed a change that we want to have the superintendent elected. This goes along with our line, as you probably know, of not reducing the number of elected officials. However, I did not intend to testify, and I will not testify either for or against it. At this point.
Would you ask your board to re-examine its position, please?
This is what was in my mind. At the present time, we have a convention again in September, and having already discussed it with some of the officers, and myself having served on the State Board of Education, I have rather in mind to try to get our position to support the appointed
I didn't know what he was going to say, really. Is there anybody else who'd like to be heard on? Yes, ma'am, come in.
My name is Betty Adams, and my address is 2180 Laurel Avenue.
Salem.
And I oppose taking away this elective office from the people. And I'm speaking for many, not only for myself, because they are our children and our schools, and we should have that privilege to elect the superintendent of schools. And when you run down Dr. Blake, as I have heard him in many sessions, because I have made it my business to look into what is going on in the public schools. And he is a man of high moral values, and I do think that he does qualify for the position of a superintendent of schools. I do not know what qualifications he would need, but I do think that he is a man of high character, and he would actually take an interest in our schools and our children. And I have had many occasions to ask him for his advice. And I have taken my child out of one private school because of some of the books that we have in our schools today, such as The New Directions in English, which is not a good English book, as I have been told that I wasn't getting my money's worth. So I put my child in another private school, which I'm very delighted with. And then we have the Hilda Taba Social Studies, which teach our children socialism. And they are in every junior high school. They're going to go to the high school level in the state of Oregon here in Salem this next year. And then we have the sex education program that a lot of people oppose. And I still say that really in greatest of interest, the people should have this privilege to vote for superintendent of schools. And I don't know what your qualifications are, but as I come to legislature and I listen to all these people, and when I hear some people on your committee talk about 12-year-olds being sexually active and that we must supply them with birth control devices and birth control pills, and I as a parent, feel that this is a crime, if it's a very unnatural way to raise a child. And then how in the world do you expect these children to live in a society and that condones this type of thing, along with the people that we have representing us, the legislature? And so, therefore, like I say, if I hear people talking against a man that is of high moral character, that had the courage to stand up and write out his own minority report when we had this state committee for sex education. And this is the kind of people we need, that have character, moral standards, and also the courage to stand up and be counted. And that's what we need in this nation, instead of having a monopoly like we do have in the public school system. And I can grant you that when you do give that privilege to the OEA, that they definitely are going to take over the school, and the parents will absolutely have no say-so. And in that respect, then I wish that we would have our own private schools, because our children belong to us, and we should have this privilege, and that's all I have to say.
Mrs. Adams, how much influence does the superintendent of public instruction have on the schools and on the school boards that are elected by the people, the local school board?
Well, I hear that the Board of Education has the most jurisdiction. The superintendent really is sort of like a rubber stamp. He does what he's told to do. That's what I've been told. And you see, my children go to a private school, and therefore I don't know much about public schools, but I do resent like I say, I would like to have a voucher system where my money goes, where my child goes, instead of really helping a school come back to its own downfall. Because there are many things in the public school system, if you actually go and look around. A lady just called me yesterday to tell me that there's the filthiest book in the library that her junior high school daughter brought, and she wants to know what she could do about it. Well, I would say that you legislators should look into some of these things yourself, because you are representing the people. And like I say, a lot of people are disappointed, and I am also, because I have attended many sessions, and when I hear legislators talking about supplying 12-year-olds with birth control devices, I talked to a police sergeant. He told me he feels exactly the same way. In fact, he's shocked. He can't understand the kind of people we have representing us.
What committee was this?
The judicial committee, where, what is it, where you want to treat 12-year-olds without the consent of their parents? And to me, what authority do you have to do this type of thing? I mean, I can't, what we need in this nation is a little common sense, I think.
A lot of it.
Well, right. So like I say, I mean, I've tried real hard to understand, and I still think that not the youth in this nation, it's the parents and the adults and the society that condones this type of thing, and our education. I'll tell you, sir, I think it needs a real good evaluation myself. Because there are things even creeping into the private schools that a lot of parents are aware of. And the only thing they'd like to have, but Dr. Blake, I'll have to quote him here. When I brought this book to his attention, he looked it over. He told me the style of the art is Maud style. Very ugly pictures. Part of the English book of psychology, asking the child, how do you feel when you get up in the morning? How do you feel when you get to bed at night? Well, this is my business, how that child feels. It's not the school's business. I mean, I'm the parent. And has nothing to do with English. So in fact, he told me that your child isn't getting the English that it should, and you're not getting what you're paying for. So, like I said, I evaluate his judgment, because he is an honest man. And he tried to help me, and I'm not sorry. Like he told me, in good conscience, you could take your child out of that school. And, he gave me two choices. I could either go to the school and have him remove the books, or remove my child. Well, I went to the school. And you know how our teachers are nowadays. They're very, they have all these degrees, and they know more than we do. So they decided that was really a good book for the book for the school. So I said, well, sister, I don't have no choice but to take my child out. And so I did, and I'm very delighted. It doesn't bother me at all. But see, I have that privilege yet. But you see, if you're going to deny a person this privilege, or your public schools are getting to be quite a monopoly. They're teaching what they want to teach. In fact, they're even teaching humanism, which is a religion. And just yesterday, I attended a session on aid to private schools. Not really aid to private school, like Father Alcorn said, that it's time that we people that are sending our children to private school have some of the tax money follow our children. because, you know, when you took your census, you do say, count our children, and you use that money in the public schools. And in all fairness, I think that if you don't help these private schools, they're going to close also. So we're not going to have a choice. We're going to have this one monopoly, and we're going to have the children learn what the OEA wants them to learn. And if you recall, humanism is a religion. When you talk about separation of church and state, I wish you would look into that. That's all I have to say.
Are there any more questions, Mr. Sanders?
Thank you very much.
Does anybody else wish to testify on House Resolution 25? Not, the hearing is closed. 1275. And we were asking the Attorney General if this were constitutional, in his opinion. And the answer is very negative. I have a copy of the opinion that.
1275?
Yes. Well, it authorized the sessions of the Legislative Assembly to be convened by joint resolution to consider matters specified in convening resolution or to be convened upon written request of a majority of members of each House. Specifies the final adjournment of constitutional or statutory session determines effective dates of enactments in that session. Since it's the opinion of the learned justices over in the Attorney General's Department, bill would be unconstitutional if it did pass.
I move HB 1275 to the table.
Thought you'd never say it. I move that we table. What? What'd you say?
1275. Isn't that what you said?
No.
To the table.
To the table. Excuse me. Look.
Shook him up.
Yeah, with that two in there, I thought you were going someplace else with it.
We got him today, 2-1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We move that House Bill 1275 to the table.
What do you want to
have here? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. I think we, without any problem, could take a vote on House Joint Resolution. Want to hear what it was, Sports Week?
Yes.
I move the House Joint Resolution 20 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
I move the House Resolution 20 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? The clerk call the roll.
John.
Aye.
Patterson.
Aye.
Aye. I'd rather not vote on these other bills without Rich having an opportunity to express his opinion.
Right.
And we did not have anybody testify on House Joint Resolution 21, and I'll see one of the sponsors to see if they want to pursue it further or if they want to forget it.
Well, I may want to be.
Is that lowering the age?
Yeah.
Subcommittee on Governmental Reorganization meeting Friday, April 9th in a work session on House Bill 1044.
To allow a county surveyor and a county coroner to have minimum qualifications established by law. In the HJR that applies to House Bill 1654, we're simply adding the word sheriff to those lists of county officers that the people have already asked to have minimum qualifications for.
Mr. Meeker, hasn't there been
a tendency, for instance, the surveyor and the coroner were added to lists of county officers that had to have qualifications to be elected.
Yes, sir.
And since that time, many of those are not elected officials, but are appointed officials. And it would seem to me that this is a first step towards having county elected sheriffs, which I disagree with.
Non-elected
sheriffs. Yes.
County surveyors are elected. All county surveyors are elected.
All no.
Yes, sir.
All rural counties.
Really?
Yeah, we elect ours.
County treasurer.
I can never remember seeing one on the ballot. I knew that.
They never have any oppositions by any.
If you will, Mr. Chairman, I would like to give you some additional testimony to indicate to you why I am so convinced that this is a necessary procedure in today's situation. There are several occupations that we have established minimum qualifications by law. Accountants, psychologists, doctors, lawyers, barbers, funeral embalmers, watch and clock makers.
But they're not elected.
I realize that, but we have established minimum qualifications for these people in profession.
You want to put these in the Department of Commerce, do you?
And I will also point out to you some of the courses that are being taught in the State of Oregon Board on Police Standards and Training. Introduction to Law Enforcement, Criminal Law, Criminal Evidence, Administration of Justice, Juvenile Procedure, Criminal Investigation, Patrol Techniques, Traffic Operations. All of the deputies in the counties that we're speaking of are qualified under this statute. It only seems reasonable that the man who administers the entire police division of the county have the same kind of qualifications. It's imperative in the situation that we have today. One sheriff commented in this way: the policeman today is a frustrated individual. He is handcuffed by the Supreme Court decision. He is a target for many minority groups. He was referred to as a pig. His pay is low. The danger is high. The present-day officer must walk softly and carry a large law library. All we're saying in this amendment to the Oregon Constitution and the companion bill is that the man have some kind of qualification to carry out the law of this state. Seems to me a very small thing required a man who's running for office, as we do for county surveyor. They have some knowledge of law.
Okay. I would suggest that you contact Lee Johnson before the committee votes on it, because I mean the four members of the committee would be a good idea to get all of with your latest testimony.
You want to get on with California? Yes, would you mind a sheriff
record
drove over here?
No,
I'm
fine.
He's got a little bit more in
well, California is doing the same thing. But there, if this goes, they must have a master's degree plus 4 years of college, or plus 4 years of experience. Or if they have only an associate degree, which is 2 years, they must have 9 years of law experience, and a baccalaureate degree must have 6 years of experience. We like to keep up with California.
What? You got your 2 years of post college and post high school. What's the importance of that? Is that so that go to community college and take
associate degree in the community colleges have a science program and associate degrees.
Any other questions of these gentlemen and ladies? Thank you.
You're not going to have more sessions today?
Yeah, but not on this bill. I mean, they're probably adopting the amendment. We're going to work on it.
Someone just called
and
asked if they were having
a work session. I don't know. On
this?
Well, that's all right.
It's
me too.
I didn't know.
Yeah, it was probably us that didn't.
Yeah, it was your secretary. Fine.
Do you have another conflict room?
Pardon me?
Do you have another conflict room? Okay.
Sure.
I want them. Okay. When do you plan to have a work session on this bill?
Well, we probably won't work on it much more. We'll just vote on it.
Well, that's what I mean.
I move the adoption of the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
The move that the amendments be adopted. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Johnson. Kennedy.
Aye.
Patterson.
Aye.
Engel.
Aye. You want to go any farther than that? Anyone want to go any farther than that? Okay. Mr. Underdahl, please.
This is set for special on the first day.
No, it's on what day? Okay, 10:44.
As to whether or not an employer to fit under this had to be actively using PERB in question, and those agencies which may have had pre-existing collective bargaining relationships prior to the passage of these amendments in the last session would even be a public employer, because they may not have implemented collective bargaining under the statute, so there's great ambiguity. The Attorney General had held one way, and there were other arguments, and so we were attempting to clean this up. So in any case, this is one of the amendments we've tried to clarify in here. The other area I call your attention to is 243.740, which is across the page here, which supposedly lays out the definition of what is the action by which a public employer elects or becomes willing to enter into collective bargaining. That's what we're trying to approach there. So that's the two of the main areas we're trying to deal with in terms of, one is redefining what a public employer is so that it includes everybody, and that isn't the device that's used to set up whether or not the employer has involved himself in collective bargaining or not. They try to use the definition device to create the option of, or willingness or the unwillingness, and it's a very tough way to deal with the problem. So what these amendments try to do is to solve that. Now, if you want to go to the amendments with that little background, we'll see if we can walk through them.
Is your amendment supposed to make it optional?
That's what the instructions we were given, was to still leave it optional the way it is at this point.
Well, now let's get into it and find out what we mean by optional.
Well, I'll get to that in a minute. I got to find my copy still. Okay, if you follow me down on the proposed amendment, the first item is merely a matter of adding another section to the amendment. The next one is the same thing. And then on page 2 of the printed bill, on line 31, where we're amending 243.745, we have, after the word employer, put the language in, who has elected to enter into collective bargaining pursuant to ORS 243.740. Now, this is the section of the law that relates to the use of PERP in resolving disputes, the bottom of the law section here. And we've said that we're just trying to qualify this in that, in dispute, we've added the language to the employer by describing him as one who has agreed to enter into collective bargaining is going to use for his dispute. It's a matter of getting some standard language going on through it.
Wait a minute now. Up here above in 5, I thought this was where we were having part of the trouble with the definition.
Well, we are, but the problem is the way the bill is laid out, and the amendments don't sequence with the problem. If the bill doesn't follow the...
Okay, and with your language, who is a school district a public employer?
No, and they weren't in the existing bill. Existing law excludes them in some way.
Well, is that part of what the bill is to try to get at, a school district too?
I don't believe so. That's the intent.
Well, I think it is.
Well, it could be, but I don't... if you look at the top of... Look at the bottom of the second page of the law. It says application provisions to teachers. ORS 243, 711, 720, 730, 740, 751 shall not apply to certificated public school personnel.
That's correct. It does not apply to teachers, but it does apply to non-certified personnel.
That's probably right.
That's
janitors,
what I had in mind.
And notice people. But I don't think we've done anything to change that, at least to consciously change anything that would relate to that question beyond what the existing law does.
Well, I think we've got to make sure what our definitions do. Does the definition include non-certified school personnel, is what I'm trying to say?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
As before, and still does, I guess.
Okay, that means city or county employees?
City or county.
Plus school non-certified employees.
That's what I would understand. It would also include water district people, apparently everybody but certificated staff, but not excluded from other women's law.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not the definition by which collective bargaining is imposed upon an employer. We deal with that someplace else in the bill.
Okay.
Anyhow, this first one, this first amendment of substance, really just adds the language by reference, the language which has elected to enter into collective bargaining pursuant to ORS 243.740. That's part of the key language. And after labor organization representing we put this insert certified, in other words, we want the access to be to labor organizations that have been certified as representing employees by PERB.
Yep.
Okay, they have to be certified as the bargaining representative to PERB prior to using PERB as the vehicle by which to resolve disputes. Okay. On page 2 of the printed bill in line 32, representing public employees complained to the public employees retirement, or that should be relations board, I don't know how retirement got in there. You change that on your form? They have to, what we're trying to do is to clarify the line, is they have to file a complaint with the relations board to get the review process that goes forward. Line 34. The bottom, the section on the bottom here has violated ORS 243.730. We've taken that language out. I'm sorry, I wasn't reading carefully. And it picks it up in the second line. Because 730 gets changed in the process, if I'm not mistaken. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
This dollar amount relates to how much you pay these people. It was up raised to $60. We just put $40 in there only to draw attention to it if you wanted to make some conscious decisions as to what the per diem for the members of the Public Employee Relations Board should amount to. Page 3, line 28.
Yeah.
Now, you can do anything you want with that. The only reason I suited the amendments is was so that we have some conscious decision on it, not just let it go by default or some number. You can pick any number you want. On page 4, lines 6 through 9, we think this language is worth keeping in the bill and probably ought to be put back in. So there should be some separation from
Wrong. 6 months immediately preceding.
Yeah, and felt there's no victory. I didn't hear any testimony supporting it being removed.
I remember Ross Morgan's appointment and Keith Wilson's appointment, and both of them were sitting in their respective chambers at the time.
Well, this is something, again, you can make a decision on. We thought that there was no, we heard no good reason to take it out, and so we left it there. Okay, now you finally get down to something with some substance to it, which is the last amendment on the first page here. And it's because the gut language is so far back in the bill, it takes us long to get to it. On page 6 of the printed bill, after where it says, on line 11, and the ORS 243.740 is amended to read. This is key language, is what we've seen in terms of what needs to be done. We've changed the word. Look to the original law here on the same section from public employers may enter into collective bargaining with labor organizations on matters concerning employment relations. Now that makes it kind of optional, but it's ambiguous, and it creates apparently in some of the minds of the legal people ambiguity. So we've made the language more specific, and I've got something further to add to what you've got on your stuff there. We deleted the language as the bill did, shall have the right, and we put in may elect or not elect to enter into collective bargaining and so forth. Now, we would add further a suggestion of council, elect by formal resolution or ordinance, so the de facto discussion of an issue, did not become a de facto entry into collective bargaining. In other words, if somebody talks to a representative of a labor union about walking to the shop and talking to people, but that didn't become a de facto election into the collective bargaining process. And apparently, this is an area.
By a formal resolution or what?
Or ordinance, or the language is important to me, but that it had to be a formal documented decision. You could add further words to it to notification to PERB of the fact of electing to enter into collective bargaining.
Okay, what does that darn thing do?
Well, this clearly makes it really clear that it's optional that a public employer has the choice or not, doesn't have the choice of entering into collective bargaining, and that's what the existing law does.
Say that again. The public employer does or does not have the choice?
Well, he can choose to go into collective bargaining, or he cannot choose. He can refuse to enter into collective bargaining. That's the existing law.
Under what circumstances can he refuse?
Any circumstance. He can now.
Does this change the intent of the bill?
I think it probably might, but I'm not sure what the intent of the bill is in that regard. You know, I didn't hear anybody flat out say that the design was to precisely to require nobody said it. Mandatory collective bargaining for every element of government throughout the whole state.
Okay, I'm a union, and I come to the city and I say I want to negotiate or bargain on these terms you've offered it. The city can say not no, but hell no.
That may not be the circumstance I would have what it would be, but essentially that's the way the existing law is.
Okay, now here we are at an impasse. What happens then?
Well, you never get to an impasse because you wouldn't really be able to bargain. If once you've begun bargaining and you've elected to enter, or if you've been in it before, that's behind you. That's down the road. It's a matter of the initial organization and agreement to bargain. And I think it's not so concerned with cities and counties so much as it is water districts. Very small.
Well, I think the promoters of the bill were concerned with cities and counties.
Well, we don't have a position. Your instructions were to leave the option in the bill so that it could be upon the action of the unit of government as to whether or not they were going to.
Well, it seems to me the bill is useless, the law is useless, if one party or the other can't say, okay, we can't agree, let's go to the conference table with the CERB.
Well, that's there, and that's not the issue. This is the right at the beginning, you know. Are we going to bargain? Are we going to have collective bargaining with our employees, City Ag? And what this does, it doesn't say you must bargain collectively. The existing law doesn't. These amendments don't. And that's the way I understood I was supposed to try to work with it, was to clarify the ambiguity that makes the definition the vehicle by which you enter or not enter.
Well, tell me about line 19.
The problem come up in the past.
Yeah. Tell me about line 19 on page 6. The first word.
Claiming?
Yeah.
Of such a public employer.
Well, I'm just wondering about the legal definition of claiming. I mean, do they represent them, or do they just claim to represent them? Has there been a vote taken, or has there?
As I understand this section in the law, this is the device by which you have a certification process, and when you're at the point in time where they will bargain collectively, and here comes up John Doe, organizer for whatever the union happens to be or the organization. And he says we claim to represent the majority of your employees, and we want to have an election to establish the fact that we are the certified representatives of your people, and that. You want to enter into collective bargaining. You've already agreed you will bargain collectively with whoever represents your employees, but you have to go through the process of certifying that there is, in fact, a majority of the employees who want to be represented by this unit or by this organization. Well, this is where this particular piece of law comes in. This is the means by which you you draw in the Public Employee Relations Board to have that certification election. That's my understanding of it. And so the claiming is the fact that they have not yet been certified.
Okay, I agree.
And
yeah, the normal situation, they have somewhere between 20-30% of the total units signed up. This would be a valid claim. Some guy comes up and claims he represents them, and he has no proof whatsoever that he's rejected.
So if you've got an employer who elected to enter into collective bargaining, and here's the representative of the employees, like the nursing thing you may have heard about up at the University of Oregon Medical School. This guy hasn't, but he might say, we think we represent this block of people.
I'm with you.
Now, they also determine what are bargaining units, as well as whether there is, in fact, a valid kind of thing. What we did by this language here is to say, and this is a suggestion of attorneys that were concerned with this particular process, we said require by adding the language of such a public employer, which relates to the people that have already agreed, that you're not going to use the certification process as a bargaining tool to force an employer to enter into collective bargaining when he may not have already elected to do so. So the only constraint is here that the public employer must have already elected to enter into collective bargaining before PIRB can hold a certification election. And there's...
Okay, does that change the intent of the bill?
I don't know if it does or not. I think it tends to qualify it. I don't think they spoke to that particular...
Once a public employer says, yes, we do want to enter into collective bargaining agreement, then that opens the door so that the labor organization can request the PERB to establish bargaining units.
Right.
And all they say is, yes, we do want to have collective bargaining.
That's the key that turns the process
right
on. The act of saying, yes, we'll enter into collective bargaining.
Why cannot local government entities bargain collectively without opening the door to the PERB? There may be no need. This does not say that we're going to have a problem and we want a third party to come in.
No. PERB in this regard only relates to this particular aspect. This doesn't.
Yes, but the bargaining units, you see, are very key.
Well, wait a minute. It says upon the request by a public employer or by a labor organization claiming to represent the public employee.
The PERB shall determine all representation issues, including unit determination. So therefore, the way the amendment reads, though, is that once the public employer says, sure, we want to have collective bargaining, or if he passes an ordinance, you can make it more specific than that. We do want to bargain collectively, then immediately either side can request the PERB can come in and establish bargaining units, which is the key, as I said before. I really think this is what one of the problems is with our local government people that come in and testify against this. Because as soon as they say, sure, we want to bargain collectively, or pass the ordinance, the PERB can step right in, and they will, in all probability, because the local unions will say, come on in.
No, that's not necessarily so. Like I said, the nurses up in medical school hospitals haven't been for certification election because they haven't got enough numbers, probably, to win that election. The fact that a government is willing to bargain collectively doesn't mean that if automatically the employees are going to organize and pick on a specific representative and get a majority. It may follow that many of them will, but it's not automatic.
What if the bedpan dumpers decide to organize as a unit? Then once the employer says, yes, we'll bargain collectively, the bedpan, and maybe only represent 1% of the total number of employees, the bedpan dumpers say, yes, we want the PRB to come in. Under this paragraph, the PRB can come in
establish bargaining units, determine all representation issues, and make investigations, hold public hearings, conduct secret ballot elections.
I'm not sure I understand this.
Who's going to, if you don't have the PERB do it, that's the whole guts of the bill. If you don't have a third party, what you want to determine these is third parties.
Yeah.
If you don't have a third party doing it, you're going to have...
But then the bedpan numbers can carve out a stupid...
Well, the point I'm trying to make, Lou, Rich, is that I think in all good, maybe not in all cases, but in most cases, most of these local government entities would be willing to bargain collectively in the broadest sense, you know. I think they would be, anyway, the ones I've talked to, and are certainly willing to. But according to this, once they admit to that, once they, by ordinance, claim that they are ready to do that, immediately a very small number of people can apply to the PERB, and they can come in and have these rights to do it.
Well, no. The PERB determines what are the units appropriate, whether they actually have enough to hold an election, see if they get through the unit. If you don't have that, you're going to have the governing body of the county or city doing it. What's happened is that in many cases, the county or city has just simply said that the bargaining unit is appropriate. As an example, ordinance, I guess you'd call it, from Umatilla County, rejecting a bargaining unit. The court is the opinion that the Umatilla County Road Department does not constitute a grouping of employees which is most consistent with the administrative organization of the county as a single, fully integrated governmental unit. What they in effect say here is that the only appropriate unit is all of the employees of the county. The only appropriate unit.
That's what FERB is there for, is to keep either the union from setting the guidelines as to what's an appropriate union,
or
the employer from setting it, to create a certain party quasi-judicial agent to do that, so that you don't get, you know, gerrymandered, chopped up bargaining units within the employer. I don't know what the alternative might be to that. And I don't know any way to allow the employer to, you know, selectively piecemeal agree to bargain. We'll bargain for our clericals, but not our engineering staff or something like, you know. I don't know how you could do it.
Well, this is the big fear of most of the local government governing budget. I think they don't want PERB to come in here. I think they're willing to bargain within budgetary limitations and relatively quickly.
It isn't mandatory that, you know, one or the other, if they can bargain together without calling PERB in, they can bargain. But if one wants to call PERB, the other can call PERB. And that's part of the instruction was to give equal access to both employees and employers to the service of PERB, primarily in, you know, in this, well, not primarily, but in any area where they can come in.
What if the wording was such, and I'm just throwing this out because I don't know that much about the problem, but what if the wording was such that the request had to come from the employer and the employee, and then PERB could be requested to solve only one part, say with determining bargaining unit, or determining some other thing. So that we use the PERB as a state arbitration board or conciliatory board or whatever you want to call it to resolve these problems. I mean, if there was an impasse.
Well, that's one. If there's an impasse on representation or bargaining units, they're charged with this piece of law to, in fact, arbitrarily make the decision like a judge. In the other areas of things beyond representation and this section, they're not given arbitration power, only conciliation or mediation, or if there's mutual agreement, they can go to arbitration. As I understand it. In other words, you both have to agree to go to arbitration before there's any arbitration possible under the way this law.
Under the way that
it only relates to bargaining and representation here. Just who represents whom and what's the appropriate unit by which you do it.
This is the thing that I really think is very, very significant part of the bill, and the one where the local government people really disagree with. It's pretty obvious to me that if, for instance, a labor organization requests bargaining unit determination, then the PERB can come in and do it.
That's the guts of the bill.
That's the guts of the bill. Right?
Local governments don't want state interference. They want to do it on their own. In other words, they want the governing body, the county, the city, to say yes or no. They say no, there's no bargaining, there's no representation, there's no nothing. That's the basic position that they testified.
We've, in drafting these amendments, we approached the problem earlier in the process. Try to make it eminently clear they can either bargain collectively or not bargain collectively. But once they had made the agreement, then PERB would be the vehicle by which they would decide bargaining units. I don't know what the alternative is. I don't know who you'd turn to. Put the circuit court in there, but they wouldn't have the money or the power to do it.
PERB is fine.
PERB is
the question
created to serve that purpose.
Whether or not the cities and counties, et cetera, are going to bargain with us. They're going to use the services of PERB.
Well, in this case, they've got it. The rest of the situation of bargaining on make sure you don't mix up the actual bargaining with the determining bargaining unit. It's quite a different relationship.
Under what circumstances, then, do the cities have to go to PERB? I guess this is my question.
Well, the primary circumstance is, one, that they have agreed
in advance
to enter into collective bargaining.
But you know, they don't have to agree to that.
No. But if they do, they still don't have to go to PERB.
They don't?
Well,
no.
But they could be pulled into PERB by
they can be pulled into PERB. They don't have to go, nor does the... No one has to go, but if one party, if there's a disagreement and one... And the one party requests it, and then the PERB makes the determination to bargain and hold the election. You've got to have somebody to hold the election.
Yeah. What happens in normal industry? There's no specific board, is there?
In LRB?
Yes, National Labor Relations Board.
Do you have a state in LRB?
We got a little one, doesn't work particularly well.
Good question.
There's one on the statutes, but it wasn't funded in the last session. I think there's a bill.
We passed a bill not long ago in the House which revised that law because it wasn't working well at all to take care of those businesses in Oregon that weren't subject to NLRB jurisdiction.
In my contract with the union, there's a clause in it that says, in case of arbitration becomes necessary, then we go to arbitration. I mean, in case we can't agree, then we can, there's a clause in it that tells how to go to arbitration.
Is there a third party in it?
Still? Yeah. NLRB in my case.
If you were newspaper business, you would. NLRB would have jurisdiction if there was a non-union newspaper, which was a number of them. They were requesting an election, NLRB would hold it.
I want to go a little ways further and we'll come back. You're going to have plenty of looking because I don't feel confident really to
well, I don't
make sure these things are
I don't either.
Are all that well well done.
It's a case of almost, trying to make it bad. If you'll excuse the analogy, I think it's a case of the blind leading the blind.
Why talking to the deaf?
No, I'm willing to listen, but I don't think you know any more about it than I do.
Let me go a bit further. Maybe we can come back and you can see how some of these things tie together when you see the other effect. Okay, we dropped out that new language on 14 and 15 on page 6. The bottom is being unnecessary language is not consistent with the redefinition of the way we change the law. So those 14 and 15 will drop out. And again, after the word employer, we keep sticking this standard language in that these things only affect the employer who has elected to enter into collective bargaining. 43740. 19, we're doing the same thing again by adding the words of such a public employer. So that there's no access to PERB for an election on representation or PERB fooling around until the city or county is elected to enter into collective bargaining formally. In other words, go to PERB and harass the city of, you know, Dayton or whoever it may be that doesn't want to enter collective bargaining. There's no way to use PERB on that kind of harassment. On lines 20 through 23, we inserted that language again. We replaced the language that we've been talking about. We put back the old language and took off the new language in that 751 section. And I think that speaks to what you're talking about. We put the old language back and took out the new language. We weren't sure nobody could tell us what determine all representation issues might mean. You know, that's pretty broad. And I don't think it makes all that much difference. Holding public hearings, conducting secret elections, determine bargaining units and representation issues.
I have a question, Matty. Why is the public employer referred to as a which instead of a who?
Employer is an entity, not a person. A city or a county. I don't know. So we took out 24 through 26. On 27, after employer, again, we stick in that same language. Who has agreed to, you know, who's elected to enter the collective bargaining? We're going to page 7, after line 17. We've inserted another section to this. A public employer or labor organization certified to enter into collective bargaining pursuant to ORS 243740 may at its discretion discontinue its use of the service of public employer relations board. And this is in the section not relating to
when can they do this?
And that's why I think it's a little bit, I don't think it should be that they can break it off in the middle of a process, but
that's my point.
You asked for some language, as I recall, so that you could discontinue.
I want both sides to be able to discontinue, but I don't want to be able to do it during the middle of the arbitration. One of the objections.
I'm not satisfied with the language, but I want to get that on paper.
One of the objections was that if you once go to PERB, you're married to it for the rest of your life, as I understand.
And that's why this added section was put in here. But it may need some detailed qualifications to express the timing and the manner by which you could disengage.
If you're going to have a public employer relations board, you can't be withdrawing from it. You don't necessarily have to use it.
No, but my understanding, Rich, was once the guy has declared that, yeah, we'd be glad to use the public relations board to settle this issue. But then 6 months comes a brand new issue.
You didn't have to go to PRB.
That's the way it's been interpreted.
No, the way it's been interpreted is that once you go in there, once you use it at all, you're a public employer. If you're a public employer, you got to collect the bargain. Once you've said to a public employer, once you've asked for their services, even to hold an election, then you're subject to the act forever. But that doesn't mean you have to use them.
Is that your interpretation?
That's an interpretation that would be very real and very threatening, but that is what I thought you were concerned with. I thought you were thinking more in terms of two. When you've got an issue, you may want some help, conciliation, working together, and they get you out there, and they send some guy down, and frankly, he's more trouble than he's worth. You say, thanks for your help, go away. I was thinking in terms of representation questions.
I don't want to be able to break off, either side to be able to break off. I want each side to be exactly the same in fairness. That's all I'm asking for in the whole damn bill.
Well, that's what we tried to do. Well, let me go on a bit further, and you can come back to that a little bit later. On page 7, after line 34, which is the end of the bill, we felt that there needed to be some amendments to another section of the law, which is in this law thing, which is ORS 243-785. And it relates to fact-finding and so forth. And inasmuch as there was reference to a public employer and a labor organization, we felt that we had to put the language in that tied the public employer back to the election to collectively bargain. And so we put that language in again to enter the election to enter the collective bargain. Okay, and going on a bit further, we added another section which goes back into the front of the bill, or front of the law again, and amends ORS 243-735, or 735, and that's back to the certification process. A labor organization certified by the Public Employee Relations Board is the exclusive representative of the employees of a public employer. We had to amend that language to make sure that we talked about the public employer who had elected to enter into collective bargaining pursuant to 740. But we want to make sure where the definition is used, and that was the basis of writing the law, we had to qualify that definition by this language to keep consistent with the intent. Okay, now if you get down into this existing law on 735, it's talking about the labor organization certified and so forth. Is the representative. However, an individual employee or a group of employees at any time may present grievances to their employer and have such grievances adjusted without the intervention of the labor organization, that's existing law. If one, the adjustment is not inconsistent with the terms of the collective bargaining contract or agreement then in effect, or second, the labor organization is given an opportunity to be present at the adjustment. Now, we felt that would be an obstacle to settling grievances if they had to have the opportunity to be present on every settlement, or they could set it aside at some later point. So we put language in that the labor organization that was certified had to be requested by the employees to be present and then have the opportunity. So if the employees didn't ask them in, that was not a basis to set aside the settlement for some reason.
see what I'm driving at?
A man and his supervisor and the guy he's supervising, they have a problem, they can solve it. The union can't find out, 3 weeks later that they had a discussion over a grievance and solved it, and they didn't have an opportunity to be present and make a flap out of it. But if they were asked to come in, then they had every right to be there. But the employee had, or a group of employees had to ask them in to put that part of it in. Then we added one other section that suggests in the council that the Public Employee Relations Board shall not certify a labor organization as the exclusive representative of members of the public employer if that public employer had not elected to enter into collective bargaining pursuant to 42.
Well, that's the whole thing right there, isn't it?
Not the whole thing. The guts of it to me is 740, which makes it clear that it's optional on the part of the public employer whether he will or won't bargain collectively. I think if there is any real thrust to this, it's mandatory collective bargaining for all units of government. That's the thrust I see in it, and I think that's where the real issue is. The rest of it is procedural. I think if they're trying to accomplish anything in the bill, and the bill as it's written would accomplish that, I think, although nobody really talks about it, the intent of the bill is to require mandatory collective bargaining by every government.
I think that's correct. Well, no, I don't know. I don't think it's that. The major purpose of the bill is to have a uniform procedure for collective bargaining, not to provide for mandatory collective bargaining. This is what the cities and the counties object to. They want to set up their own procedure. That's exactly what happened. You got the city of Eugene, now we have everybody, except the firemen, are under one collective bargaining law. Present state law, firemen are on an entirely different
state law.
No, ordinance that the firemen initiated themselves and which the people approved, which was just upheld in the court, the Circuit Court of Wayne County, a few weeks ago. And the only reason the city of Eugene elected to become a public employer was to head off the firemen's ordinance.
Oh, I like to try these amendments out on.
That's what I suggest. Take them and make some copies. And what do you think of the people that you can, take the council? I've sent copies to our personnel division. They say we think they'll do what you indicated were your instructions. We also got a guy in the Attorney General's office to look at them, and who had some experience in collective bargaining. He made a couple of these suggestions in terms of clarity. One was the last one I just mentioned. Don't let PERB certify when the unit of government is not already elected to bargain, because that becomes a pressure, leverage to get very coercive.
I don't think they can do that now.
I don't know if they can or not. To make it absolutely clear that they can, because you change the definition of a public employer. See. Now, the question, was raised in this as part of the testimony, is that the definition of public employer means that nobody's a public employee unless they work for a public employer, and then all of the restrictions against public employees as regard to strikes don't apply unless you've got a collective bargaining situation under this. Now, the Attorney General has held differently, but as Chuck Wilson said, lawyers disagree until it's out of the court. You really don't know, so you're operating in a bit of jeopardy. That if you didn't get a strike or something, like the thing, somebody could say, we're not public employees. Just read that law and you'll see that we're not subject to the act. And they're not bound the way a state, what the state agency is, they turn down the thing. And it would be very interesting court case. So we want to avoid that, and that's a good reason to try to change some of that language. And that's the kind of things you pick up without speaking to them in the legislation and clarity on some of these other issues.
Did you look at Dick Baum's amendments or anything you like to do with them?
I looked at an awful lot of them, but many of them were far and beyond your instructions as to what you wanted to accomplish. I had the opinion you wanted to clarify the definition to make sure that all those other things went in and require that it remain optional as to whether or not a city or county join and provide, you know, equal and fair access to the service.
The general idea.
And that's the thrust that I try to do without.
I'd like to hear Keith talk about the darn thing, and I'd like to hear the county man talk about these amendments.
Well, they'd like to get a shot at them and work on them, and I think that's what you do is probably this proposed composite of you're going to have to separate, you know, there may be all kinds of comments that won't relate to what you want to do with the bill. You know, there may be comments that you want to do this, you want to do this, you want to do this, which aren't responsive to what you'd like to accomplish with the legislation. I'm not sure you know yourself what you want to accomplish.
I'm not sure either.
But you all want to accomplish the same thing.
Rick says he knows. We'd like to make it uniform throughout the state.
Yeah, that's the major objective. We don't end up, if we'll probably end up with a big mess of different kinds of collective bargaining procedures in local government. That is a major objective.
When there's two philosophies, one saying that that local office should stay, one saying should be uniform to us.
The bill in no way forces the local governing body to participate if they don't elect to do so. And that's why I put that in so many different places where it has elected to make that eminently strong and clear that it's optional.
I personally think that they ought to be required to bargain. You feel they should be required to bargain. Providing the employees.
Yeah, I know. I kind of feel the same way. Very much the same way.
Things that this bill is designed to do, I have 10 on their merits alone, and you put the two issues together, and you're very apt to not solve either problem.
Well, at a minimum, if you're going to be collective bargaining, ought to be one procedure for local government.
Well, that's what I would like to see. Really, I think that's what's necessary, is we establish procedure, but I don't think it's necessary to establish that the PERB intervene in every case, and sure as hell, that's what's going to happen.
Well, it's that legal protection, you know.
If there's a dispute, if the county has agreed to bargain, and then there's a dispute about bargaining units, who represents who, you'll have the LCIO, the Oregon State Employee Association, or we have two unions. We have a teamster union and a municipal. They're fighting each other. You've got to have a third party resolve who in fact represents those people. Or in fact, if anybody represents those people.
See, this nursing thing, to go back to that again, was, you know, underneath it all, there was an organizational effort going on, and that's what was involved, because many of the issues that they were making noise about had already been solved.
As long as the public employees can't strike, I kind of feel that the employer should be required to bargain in good faith to negotiate in good faith.
There's nothing in the law that requires them to agree.
They're in a very peculiar situation, frankly, because there's three parties. That the employer, the employee, and you've got the public.
Well, the employer is representing the public.
I realize that, but in all cases, that's very difficult to make that as a statement. It's not always the case.
But we've been facing the right here in this spot. Well, let's throw these amendments out to both sides and see what the comments are.
My big problem right now is I'm supposed to talk to my county employees on this bill Monday night and have the faintest idea.
We'll try to explain to them how complicated it is.
Uniform procedures.
You think the thinking of the guy to put this bell in was an effort to get uniform procedures, is that it, right?
Yeah, that was a major thing.
I think this goes in the wrong direction. I don't think he was hurt that at all.
Violated that principle.
I don't think he violated that principle. We have not made it eminently clear that it remains to be optional as whether a public employer will bargain or not.
In their original bill or amendment, do they have that same idea in mind, that it's the option?
Well, I think it's ambiguous in the present law. And some of the things that they've written in here, now they changed the public employer language, and they had some language in here in 740 that with the language that public employers shall bargain collectively in good faith with labor organizations on matters concerning employment relations. And that, and they changed the definite position of public employers to include everybody. That sounds to me like a very strong mandate to mandatory collective bargaining. The question as to whether public employers may enter into collective bargaining goes back to an old question that was asked the Attorney General a long time. Is it legal for a public body to bargain collectively? Do they have the right to do it? And the answer is sure, they legally may enter it. But that isn't the language was not intended to make it optional. It was making to say that it was legal for them to enter in. The next paragraph, and it's the key words are port lines 14 and 15 on page 6, which says public employers shall bargain collectively in good faith with labor organizations on matters concerning employment relations, and that's everything. That's the new as mandatory collective bargaining.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's a better bill.
Okay, well, try it out on both sides and see what we got.